Good morning. I'm Eleanor Seggy, an editor at MoneyWeb. With us today is Kerry Mongi, Director of Talent Solutions at CEB South Africa. She will be explaining the challenges and importance of leadership. Welcome, Kerry.
Morning.
Kerry, could you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and your background and give us a short introduction to CEB?
Sure. So, my background is mainly in industrial psychology. I'm a qualified industrial psychologist, but started working at CEB about 11 and a half years ago. And my focus and my engagement in working for CEB is really around the difference that we make in people's lives. So CEB as a company, their main focus is in terms of best practice insight and technology, and that's largely who we are as a company. So we basically help about 20,000 senior leaders every year to make changes within their business to ensure that they have successful businesses and that they can respond to changes in the environment and so on. Basically through helping them to effectively manage their talent, their customers and their operations so as to achieve their objectives. And yeah, so that's where my passion lies and where I'm really interested in helping change people's lives.
It's really interesting. Just a reminder to listeners, if you have any related questions that you'd like Kerry to answer during this webinar, please submit them via the webinar question window. Alternatively, you can mail them to me at eleanors@moneyweb.co.za. So that's Eleanors. Kerry, according to your research, why is it that most planned strategic changes fail?
So what we found in our research is that typically most large organizations have undergone at least 5 enterprise changes in the last 3 years. I mean, that's pretty significant. And those are large changes. So things like mergers and acquisitions, restructuring, new leadership teams. So it's not small changes that are going to have very little impact. The challenge that we found in our research is that These changes are failing. They're not being implemented correctly. And the main reason that we've identified for that is that the executives don't believe, up to 82% of the executives don't believe that they have the right talent in their business in order to enable the change. However, when we speak to the talent and we speak to the employees of business, they have a different view on it. And their feeling is that the change really comes, it's pushed down from the top. So you have your leadership teams who put together the vision and the strategy and the change that needs to take place. And that basically gets cascaded and communicated down. And then the employees are just expected to adapt to that and to change. And what's compounding on that is we know that 73% of organizations are expecting more change initiatives in the next 3 years. So changes are happening. They're not being successful. We know more changes are coming. The world is constantly changing. Industry is constantly changing. And now employees are not changing with it. And it's not because that they're not willing to change. It's because they don't know how they're expected to change. So what our research shows us is that the employees get told they need to change, but they don't know how. And so only 26% agree that they've actually changed their own behavior and the way in which they work in order for the change initiative to be successful. So obviously that leads to the impacts on the bottom line. Companies are not being successful anymore, even though they expect huge successes after a change initiative. So one of the main reasons and or solutions for that is to look at something called open source change. So the focus of open source change is really on collaborating with the employees and with the talent within the organization to do the change initiative together. So getting input from the rest of the business, working together, building teams that are going to drive the change initiative. So to get buy-in, to get the collaboration, and to understand really what's happening, you know, at the employee level, because senior leaders assume that this is how employees are going to respond to the change. These are the changes that are required for them to be successful. And they're turning around saying, no, sorry, that's not what's required. So through open source change and collaboration, it's important that they then build the plans together, build the change strategies together. It's not to say that everyone is capable of change or wants to change. So an important part of that is obviously identifying who has the capabilities, who wants to work in that in those collaborative teams who wants to help build the strategy, make the changes happen. And that leads to much more successful changes. It reduces the amount of time people spend through the change process. The changes are so much more successful, so the business doesn't lose as much money during the change programs and change initiatives, because they can pick up on the problems so much quicker and fix those.
It's quite an innovative solution. Which professions do you find seem to have the greatest demand for skilled, suitable business leaders?
So I think it's across most professions. The demand, particularly we're noticing more and more these days, is in areas such as more your technical types of professions. So areas such as software developers, industrial engineers, a lot of roles within the finance space. So it's roles that require people to be quite comfortable with the technology and with all the changes in technology and with data analytics. That's becoming a huge requirement. So that's where we're really noticing that there's a critical gap in terms of talent. And so what's happening is, because the talent's not coming in, it's obviously affecting the leadership pipeline and the succession planning. And that's, you know, to your point around the leadership and the professions that are where we're seeing gaps.
There seems to be quite a lot of competition in a limited talent pool if companies choose to recruit to go that route. What are some of the reasons for the lack of suitable and available talent?
So there are a couple of reasons for that. Maybe to just give a bit more background to the gaps in the talent space and so on. If we don't start to understand what's impacting on the talent and the shortage of talent, should I say, it's going to start to lead to salary wars, and it's going to start to lead to hyper competition between different organizations. And what companies typically do is they look at their competitors within their own industry. And so they start to look at, well, why is one finance institution competing with another finance institution, for example, for talent? And what are they doing to get the better talent in? And if you look at the types of roles where there's a shortage in talent, it's across industries. So very often, banks, for example, it's assumed that they don't employ engineers, but they do. There are a lot of engineers working in the banking environment. And so when organizations look at their competition, they make it very narrow in terms of looking at where they need to be sourcing talent from. So that's one of the things, is to broaden the way or the areas in which they're looking for talent. It's also important to start to look at the brand and the way in which an organization positions themselves. So that's also quite key. So, for example, things such as location, the industry. There's some industries that are just not attractive and appealing to people. So probably less so in the finance space that we're specifically looking at today. But, you know, if you look at some of the mines, for example, people don't want to go and work out in Rustenburg. They want to be in Sandton. They want to be in the hub, you know. They want to be central, especially young people. If they leave university, they want to stay where there's a social life and so on. Moving out to a mine is not so appealing to them. So, you know, there's small things like location, industry, the type of industry, the size of organizations and so on. So that obviously limits the talent pool quite a bit. Then we also find that candidates just aren't that eager to apply for jobs. They want the jobs to come to them. So they're not so, we find that 44% of candidates indicate that they would welcome direct contact from recruiters, and they're happy to put on their LinkedIn profile their education and their experience and so on. But in terms of actually making that effort to phone the company to say, I'd like to come and meet you, I'd like to see what you do, yes, I'm prepared to travel for an interview or to complete some online assessments or whatever the recruitment process looks like, that's dropped significantly. They want people to deliver it to them. And so that also has an impact on why there's a shortage of talent. Then obviously lack of supply we know that there's a skill shortage in South Africa. And it's interesting, it's not only in South Africa. So even in America, we're finding now that there are less and less people studying science and maths and, you know, going into those types of subjects and degrees that industry is looking for. So it's you know, it's not only a South African problem where we often think that there's a huge skill shortage in South Africa, which there is, but if companies aren't being successful, they're not growing, and then they're not employing and developing more talent. And then I guess the last main reason is the over-specificity that hiring managers expect. So when they speak to HR and they ask for this is what I want, they kind of expect these this absolute perfection that they're going to get, this absolute ideal. And so they get very, very specific and they look for things that you may not find, you know, in one person. There is an example, also an American example, where in San Francisco, there are approximately 22,000 data scientists in the area with 3 to 7 years work experience. That doesn't sound too bad. But when you look at the additional qualifications that these data scientists need and the additional system knowledge and programming knowledge that they need, it reduces it down to 60 people.
Wow.
So you've got 22,000 people who've got the skill, 60, but we make it so narrow and we want it so specific. We've got a client in the finance space in South Africa who, when they run their grad recruitment program, they no longer look at academic, how you've performed in your academic degrees. They look at it later on in the recruitment process, but your typical graduate program, organizations will screen out if you didn't get an average of C, for example, for your degree, even B sometimes. And so what you're getting is you're getting people who are really good at academics. They're not necessarily good at being in the working world. They don't necessarily have the behaviors and the competencies that are required in the working environment. Can they study a textbook, write a good exam? Yes, they can. So what one of our clients in the finance industry is actually doing is their initial screening is, do you have a degree or will you have a degree by the end of the year? Not did you get an A or a B? And then they look at their behaviors and their competencies and everything else that's required for the job and required to be successful within that specific organization. And only later on do they start to look at academics. So they found that where they would previously have removed a whole lot of potential candidates because they were being so narrow by only looking at candidates who had A's and B's, they've now broadened that candidate pool. They're getting great talent into the business, not focusing purely on academics. So the moment we broaden the pool in which we're looking for the talent, we can get in great talent. Skills can be taught. Knowledge can be taught. The types of behaviors that drive that ambition, the behaviors we require for change agents that we spoke about just now, those things are more difficult to teach. So if you're looking for those type of behaviors, you can broaden your talent pool, and then there's a greater chance of bringing in great talent.
Mm. It's more of an innate sort of behavior or characteristic rather. Just to take you back a step, why do you find that job seekers currently are adopting this sort of entitled come to me approach?
So I think it's partly because of, I mean, we always talk about the different generational groupings and so on. I think it is partly that, but it's also partly, you know, millennials typically want things given to them. But it's also partly that they don't want to go through the effort if they don't see the value in going through quite a stringent recruitment process. They don't. And what's happening is because on average, most people apply, especially people leaving university, apply for about 5 different jobs, not necessarily knowing whether they want to work for that company or whether they want to actually do that specific role. But they send their CV out. They want, you know, they apply on the different online applications. And so what happens is recruiters then spend a lot of their time on people who are not even that engaged in the process. And by doing that, it extends the recruitment process. So then the candidates get frustrated. They don't want, you know, they want feedback immediately. They don't want to apply today and in 4 months' time still not know if they've got the job. They want to apply today, do an interview tomorrow, do some online assessments, maybe do a second interview, and they want to know that they've got the job. And so because the process is being more and more delayed, because recruiters are so busy and getting inundated with candidates who don't meet the requirements, it's really delaying the process. So that also frustrates them. And then it's small things like technology. You know, they want to be able to apply online. They want to be able to, as I say, move through the process quickly. It needs to be efficient. It needs to engage them. It needs to be attractive. It needs to give them a realistic preview of what the job's about, what the company's about, without them having to phone the company, go and do the research. It must be there. It must be at their fingertips. So that's also an important element to consider.
We can be quite a demanding sort of generation.
And yet we, the generation that's, and the millennials are the generation that's going to push the businesses into the next, you know, the next growth curve and where they need to be.
Of course, to be innovative.
And it's interesting that millennials actually like to be coached by the older generations, by the baby boomers. They want to learn about the business from not someone who's 2 years older than them, but someone who's 10, 15, 20 years older than them. And having said that, they can teach the older generations about the new technology and the new and exciting models. But the technology is changing so quickly that whatever you learn at school, at university, is outdated by the time you get your first job. So yeah, there's so many different variables to look at, but it all speaks to efficiency and driving the process so quickly and being aware of the need to change in the moment, you know, being proactive rather than reactive.
So the definite advantages to dealing with millennials, which is great. Given that, in the current market, what approach should companies then take in sourcing talent?
As I mentioned earlier, it's very much around expanding the market in which an organization is sourcing their talent from, but also looking at more a needs-driven sourcing approach. So what I mean by that is understanding what the market can provide and aligning that to what the business needs. So it's really important for HR to speak to the specialist positions and the roles that they're wanting to fill and really understand what's required within those organizations from a talent perspective, but understanding, as I said, what the market can deliver. So not over-promising and saying, yes, we can find this perfect individual who's got every specific qualification, knowledge, skill, experience, et cetera, that they're looking for, but being able to marry those two between what the organization requires and what the market can deliver. So that's what we mean by a needs-driven sourcing approach. And then there's a much bigger pool, which obviously if you just look at straightforward maths, you know, your selection ratio is that much bigger in terms of how many people are available for the different jobs. And if they are more flexible, we see significant savings. So if organizations are more flexible in terms of the talent that they bring in and understanding what the market can offer and can provide, we see things like cost savings of up to $1.8 million per 1,000 vacancies. And as I say, the recruiters are then focusing where they should be and not on all these people who don't have the skills, don't have the requirements, or only focusing, like that example I gave, of narrowing down 22,000 to 60 people, and there's loads of companies wanting to employ those 60 people. So you just sit there with years of trying to recruit the right talent.
1.8 million, that's incredible.
It's huge.
So I have heard of this talent audit before. Can you tell us what talent audit is and why companies should consider using them?
Okay. So we've spoken a lot about recruitment so far and sourcing talent, but obviously it's important for organizations to understand the talent that they've got within the organization. We've spoken about skill shortages. Organizations want to obviously retain their top talent, but they also want to know how strong their talent is. Where do the strengths lie? Where do the development areas lie? So you'll find that most organizations are quite comfortable doing financial audits and risk audits and technical audits and so on, but often the talent's forgotten about, the employees are forgotten about. And it's important to do audits on the employees as well, especially if the organization is planning to go through some sort of change, which we know is inevitable. So a talent audit is really around identifying what the company requires or a function within a company. It's not necessarily the whole company. Identifying what the company requires now and looking a little bit long term into the future. So what does the strategy tell us is going to be required of the talent? And then to assess the current talent to see, well, where are the strengths and where are the gaps? Because then that can answer questions around what development's required, to get the employees to the level that they need to be or have the knowledge and the skills that's required for to achieve the objectives and the strategy that's been planned for the future. Also, it helps them to identify additional talent that they may need. So how many or the types of employees that they would need to bring into the business to help support the current staff that they have, rather than just employing clones of each other, but what skills are missing and lacking and what additional skills do they need. So that's really in a nutshell a summary of a talent audit. And so it's really to identify our current picture. What do we have? And then from there, they can focus on so many additional projects and objectives. So succession planning, identifying their high potentials, who their next leaders are within the business. So it's really a snapshot of the current talent performance at a given point in time.
Can you think of any examples of where this has been successfully used and, you know, sort of what sort of companies specifically should be using this type of approach?
So I think the easy answer is all companies, but it's really in a space where, you know, there's some specific needs. So very often we notice if there is a new leadership team, they're quite interested in doing a talent audit so that they can understand what the business looks like before and after mergers and acquisitions. So when you're trying to combine two teams together, for example, from two different organizations, so what does that talent look like in the two organizations? Again, where do our strengths lie? Where do our gaps lie? Before an acquisition, to see, well, what does the talent look like? And then just in teams that maybe don't seem to be, you know that they could be better or there's something missing, but you're not quite sure what. And that's why I say it can be applicable to any organization. It really just gives, you know, if you think about it, I mean, audits, financial audits are done regularly. Talent audits can be done just as regularly. It gives such valuable information, and that information can be aggregated. So then we start to look at trends and data. And then we can also start to benchmark one organization with competitors, with other organizations to see, well, you know, how does our talent stack up? Because that, again, impacts on an organization's competitive strength. If they've got the best talent, then that really helps them to position themselves ahead of other organizations.
I like the fact that it could potentially reignite passion in existing employees without having to, you know, go out and search for the perfect employee, as you've said before.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. It shows an investment in the talent they've got. It creates that engagement. And we always encourage things like development, you know, ongoing development once we've identified those development areas. And yes, to your point, it's just, you know, the company's investing a bit in me, not in the new starters the whole time. And then you can, the company and the individuals can see that return on investment. They can see their own improvement in their job. And obviously, as each employee starts to improve, the company improves as a whole.
Just a reminder to our listeners, if you have any related questions that you'd like Kerry to answer, please submit them via the webinar question window. Alternatively, you can email them to me at eleanors@moneyweb.co.za. Kerry, what type of leadership is needed today? I know we've covered this quite a lot, but sort of just, you know, in a succinct answer. And why is it important?
More specifically today, the type of leadership that's required is what we term at CEB a enterprise leader. And what an enterprise leader essentially is a leader that does the traditional behavior or performs the traditional behaviors that we've all heard of. So the transactional competencies, the transformational behaviors. So you set the vision and the strategy and you implement that. But the one challenge that's experienced with that, looking at it more from a traditional view, is that it creates a very silo type approach. So a finance director or a CFO is responsible for their finance function, and that's what they look at and that's what they focus on. And the HR director sits in the HR space and they focus on that and so on. And if we look at what organizations are requiring going forward is more of what we call network leadership. So it's that integration across silos. And I mean, this has been spoken about for years, but leaders can no longer do it by themselves. They need that support of the other leaders. We all have strengths. We all have development areas. But if I work with my colleagues on my exco team to see, well, where do their strengths lie? Where do their developments lie? we can support each other, we can help each other out. But the network then also needs to be pushed further down into the organization. So it's important for employees to work as teams. It's important for leaders to be able to introduce employees to each other where it adds value. So it's not that the leaders are expected to make all the decisions any longer or have all the answers. It's important that the leaders know, if I get asked a question from one of my employees that I can't answer, who can answer that question? How can I build that network? How can I, you know, get various individuals to network together to build a relationship in order to make a decision? So that's the additional part to the transactional and transformational leadership competencies that are required.
So it hopefully would develop or inspire leadership throughout the whole company then?
It develops and inspires leadership, and it also has a significant impact on the bottom line. So, I mean, we see significant improvements in revenue and obviously in profits if leaders display enterprise leadership behaviours rather than working in the silo.
It's fantastic. Yeah. What are some of the challenges you experience in recruitment and succession planning? I know we have sort of delved into this a bit.
So, yeah, I think recruitment we've touched on quite a bit. So the challenges is really around there is a talent shortage, and it's really around just being more efficient, more effective in the recruitment, broadening that pool. And then I think in terms of the succession planning, the challenges there are really around identifying what's required for the leaders, as we spoke about now. So knowing that we need network leaders, you know, that's required in organizations in the next few years. And then how do we identify the talent required to move through that succession pipeline? So again, having that proactive approach to say, we know in 2, 3, 4 years' time, there's going to be churn, there's going to be turnover at the leadership level. That's natural in any organization. So how do we start to identify the talent today? And the assumption is very often that if I'm good at my job today, I'm going to be good as a leader in the future. And when we spoke about specialist type roles, your engineers, your finance specialists and so on, it's not automatic or natural that people want to become leaders or managers. It's maybe that they want to stay in a specialist role. And so what organizations typically do is they focus very much on current performance, predicts future performance, and they assume that if you're currently performing well, you're going to therefore be the next good leader, and you get put into the succession plan or this high potential project, and then you actually don't want to be there. So succession planning is important both from the business perspective to understand types of leaders, what the future looks like, but then to identify the right talent, people that are engaged, people that want to become leaders. And then what do you do with those who don't, the specialists, and engaging them? And that's really the focus and the challenge around succession planning. We do it too late. We do it when we suddenly have to fill a role, and we don't always do it with the right people.
So it should be more of an ongoing process.
100%. Succession planning should be ongoing, yeah.
And then just lastly from me, from CEB's perspective, what is predictive analytics and why is it a potential solution to these challenges?
So predictive analytics is really around looking at, I mean, analytics is used in many areas of business, but again, it hasn't been used too much within the talent space. And so it's really around understanding and collecting all the data that organizations have on talent. So performance data, assessment data, you know, doing assessments for development, for recruitment. But it's really around taking all that data, aggregating it, and understanding what does that tell us about the business? And not only about our business, but let's compare it to other companies within our industry to see, well, what does that tell us about us and our talent in relation to our competitors, in relation to other organizations? It's also looking at what companies are doing globally. So it's looking at your own data, it's looking at other information, other data, and then using that to start to predict, well, if our data looks like this and research data looks like something else, then what do we need to do in order to get to there? So the example I gave around the leadership, we know that companies require enterprise leaders. So let's look at our current leadership team. Let's see, do we meet those requirements? No, we don't. So what do we need to do to close that gap? So that's really what we're looking at in terms of predictive analytics, is what are we doing today with the data that we have on our talent to make decisions for the future.
Again, quite an innovative approach, and I'd imagine that shareholders would be quite interested in seeing that enacted in companies.
100%, because if you do it correctly and if you use that data, it doesn't just sit on a system somewhere, but you actually use the data and unpack that data and what it means for you, we see significant improvements. You can implement solutions where you can actually quantify the return on investment. So again, when you look at talent, very often it sounds like nice to haves, it's not quantified. HR processes, plans that are put in place, succession planning, all those types of, they sound like nice to have programs, they're actually essential. And if done correctly, using the data to support it, you can show the return on investment. You can show that your sales have increased. You can show that your employee turnover has decreased. You can show your increase in revenue. So you can quantify it. If you don't use the data and you don't use the information at hand and you just implement it because everyone else is doing it, it's very difficult to quantify the return on investment of the project.
For sure. And then just onto our listener questions. What are your views on the importance of supervisors with regard to the execution of an organization's strategy? In this case, supervisors being first-line leaders or team leaders, the lowest level in a triangular organogram?
So I think supervisors definitely have a very important role to play. I've already touched on it a little bit, so I'll just quickly summarize. Supervisors, just the same as leaders, have, your more senior leaders, have to focus on network leadership, so that, that decision-making, that working as a team, that needs to cascade down. It's not only senior leaders that are responsible for everything. When we spoke about change, we need to start including supervisors, employees within that change space. Again, it's not only the senior teams that they need to cascade the change initiatives down. But what is important is, as I mentioned just now, not everyone's going to be a supervisor. Not everyone's going to be the next CEO of the company or MD of the company. And so, often supervisors get made a supervisor because they're the person who's been in the team the longest, or they're the person who puts up their hand, instead of understanding what a supervisor role requires. So they are important, but we need the right people in those jobs.
Okay. And then just lastly, do you find that the challenge of identifying real talent is sometimes hidden when an incompetent leader is appointed? Is this a norm in South Africa?
So I can't say that it's necessarily a norm in South Africa, but I think it could be a problem. And so I'm not directly answering the question, but the challenge that we sit with in very much the HR space and the talent management space, in a traditional HR space, is that we don't, and I say we very broadly, not all, a lot of HR executives are getting better at this, but we don't speak the business language. We don't show the return on investment. We don't show the value. We don't show how that change initiative or that succession plan or that high potential project or whatever actually has changed and made the business more successful. And so what happens is leaders don't consider talent the same way they do finance or sales or any other area of the business, because they don't see the value in it. So the moment we can start to show the value, the moment leaders will be more open to seeing the value in the talent.
It's fascinating. Kerry, do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
If there are no more questions.
No more questions at this time.
Good.
Thank you so much for your time today. It's been really interesting.
It's a pleasure.
And thank you for having me. Listeners.